Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You remember the old adage, as goes the avatar, so goes the gamer. Not ringing a bell? Well, it's true. A new study found that players in the virtual reality game Second Life mirror their avatars when it comes to losing weight and, more importantly, keeping it off. And here to explain how playing video games can living in those virtual worlds can possibly help you stay slim is co-author of the study, Deborah Sullivan, who chairs the University of Kansas Department of Dietetics and Nutrition. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sullivan.
Good morning.
First of all, can you tell us a little bit about Second Life, what it means, and why you decided to do a study like this in the first place?
Sure. Well, Second Life is a virtual reality platform that was developed by Linden Labs, and it's a three-dimensional world on your computer. It's free for anyone to sign up and use it, and it's been used by universities across the world, actually, in recent years to teach classes. And I decided to use it because our university had bought an island, which is, basically what they refer to as land in Second Life. And some of the faculty on campus were using it to teach classes. And when I first, heard about it, I thought, well, that is crazy. And then the more I thought about it, I realized I'd be crazy to not use it for weight management programs. And so we did a study to look at whether using, Second Life, the virtual reality platform, for weight loss and maintenance would be effective and feasible. And, as you reported, in fact, it was. And our people in our virtual reality platform did better in maintaining weight than our traditional face-to-face group.
Did that surprise you?
It didn't. That was what we had, I had hypothesized that it would.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that because in Second Life, they could practice behaviors. In real life, we ask people to go, practice behaviors, healthy behaviors, and they often don't do it. And so in Second Life, they can practice the behaviors, they can repeat them, and there's no negative consequences if you get it wrong. If I ask you to to go to the grocery store in real life and read food labels, that takes time and some people are uncomfortable doing it. But in Second Life, 24 hours a day, you could go to my virtual grocery store and click on the different food items and learn, the calorie and fat content of the items.
And you can do it without having somebody walk by and you imagine them thinking or whispering, well, she should be looking at the this or that.
Exactly. And the same thing, with our virtual gym. A lot of people, especially overweight people, are very intimidated to walk into a gym. Maybe they've never used a treadmill and they perceive when they walk in, everybody's going to stare at them. And so in virtual reality, you can go into our, gym and you have an avatar. And so, we think people really identify with their avatar and become, emotionally invested. And when my avatar is running on that treadmill, I know I'm not burning calories in real life, but the person gets comfortable walking into a gym because it looks identical to what a real gym would look like. Your avatar gets onto the treadmill. And it's set up. It's a three, and your avatar actually touches the buttons just like you and starts it just like you would in real life. And so the person gets comfortable doing this so that when they go in real life, they can actually be comfortable walking into that gym.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and my guest is Dr. Deborah Sullivan. She teaches clinical nutrition at the University of Kansas Medical Center. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking about a study she did on the impact of participating in Second Life and its impact on people who to maintain weight loss. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So in this initial study, all 20 of the participants did a weight loss program first, and then you tested their weight maintenance with Second Life.
Well, actually, the first 3 months, we compared our traditional, 10 of them did our traditional in-person weight loss group, program, and 10 of them did the weight loss in Second Life. So instead of coming weekly to the conference room in person, their avatar went to our virtual conference room, and we did the exact same class in Second Life. So we tested the weight loss in Second Life and compared to our traditional face-to-face. Mm-hmm. And both of those, at the end of 3 months, they both lost very similar amounts of weight.
Okay.
So Second Life was an effective way to lose the weight. And then in the maintenance section side of the study, which is what we were mostly interested in, the other group did switch to Second Life. And so we had both groups were in Second Life, and we compared the weight maintenance. And I think because the total Second Life group that had been Second Life the entire time were more used to doing Second Life, and they went more time in Second Life, and that group actually maintained their weight better than our traditional group did.
What is the challenge of weight loss maintenance anyway? If you've gone to all the trouble to lose the weight, what have we found is the challenge to maintaining that? Why can't people do that?
I think because if you follow a diet, no matter what diet program it is, if you follow it and do what you're supposed to do, you cut the calories, you're going to lose the weight. And so whether I'm doing, you're doing our weight loss program, or you're doing Weight Watchers or Jenny Craig or, Jared's Subway diet, if you're following a specific regimen and you're cutting your calories, you're going to lose weight. And most people perceive that weight loss is a short-term thing. I'm going to go on my diet, change my behaviors for a short time, and then I go back to my regular eating habits. And what happens is people stop they stop thinking about what they're eating. They go back to their usual habits, and they're overeating, and they're not exercising, and they gain that weight back. So you need to get them to maintain those healthy behaviors.
What was some of the feedback you received from the participants, just anecdotally?
So we actually did structured interviews with the participants at the end to try to get their feedback on what they felt about the program. And it was, they all enjoyed it. There was no negative consequences. Some of the advantages were the fact that they could do it. They could go back and they could practice 24 hours a day if they wanted some of those behaviors. We are currently in the process of we're going to redo this project with on a bigger scale,
mm-hmm.
With an adequate sample size to really answer the questions. And we plan to explore some of those other things that we think made a difference, but we didn't really have a big enough sample size in our original study to answer those questions.
Is the sample size the only thing that's going to change with the next study?
No, we are really amping up what's on our island. Our original study, the original study, we had a conference room, a house, a gym, a grocery store, a restaurant, and a buffet that we had activities for the people. We've got all those in our new island, but we've also added a fast food area, a convenience store, a walking trail, biking, a pool, a library, a lot more, and then sort of what we're calling like a mindful eating room or a success room, sort of some of the psychological things we think are important. So just adding a lot more activities for the people to participate in on the island.
For the 10 people in the original study, the 10 people that did the weight loss program on the island, how did they pick their avatars? What did their avatars look like at the beginning? And did they, then the weight loss, was that reflected in the, in what the avatars look like?
That is a great question. And when I first started thinking about using Second Life, that's what I wanted to try to do, would be to have the avatars change. They didn't. So when you join Second Life, you can get your free avatar, and you can personalize it however you want it to look. You get with like a standard man or woman, and then you can modify that. Most of our people, just their avatars just looked like whatever they want them to look like, and they did not change as the people themselves lost weight through the program.
I wonder if there's a way to do that.
There is. There is a way you could change the avatar. We decided that, it was just beyond the scope for our original mm-hmm. project.
Are you going to shoot for that for the second one?
Not yet.
Okay.
We want to try to just, answer some in our original questions. I think down the road I would like to do that, but it's really probably that's more of a very, not very different, but a somewhat different study, because it would be I think probably more looking at more of the psychological issues.
Well, so versus in this case, it just says to me behavior. So much has to do with behavior and patterns of behavior and patterns that we've gotten into. I know with smoke stoppers, they talk about the first time you'll go to a wedding and not have a cigarette, or the first time you'll go to a bar, the first time you'll do this and the first time you'll do that, and to get past those firsts and that sort of a thing.
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the ways people have other people sabotage them, right? You go out you go with your friends to, you know, out to dinner or something, and they say, oh, come on, we always do margaritas and chips, you know, what are you talking about? You won't do it. And people don't know how to respond to that. And in the real world, people hate role-playing. But somehow in Second Life, because it's your avatar doing it, and, you know, we give the people a headset so you can actually talk real-time. Your avatars can talk among each other. We do role-playing. We actually role-play, how do I respond? You know, when someone says, oh, go ahead, you know, drink the margarita, what's it going to hurt? And they can actually practice responding to those situations. And when they get confronted in real life with that sort of a situation, they feel comfortable answering.
Well, in the Second Life, though, is everybody that they're talking to going through the same thing?
Most of the avatars there, but then, you know, we've got the health educators, the dietitians that are teaching the classes.
Okay.
And, you know, we come up with, and we, you know, so we provide
you
information.
Evil avatars that sneak in and
No, you know, but we do set up the scenarios where, you know, it's this, but sometimes they can bring up their own scenario. Here's something that happens to me. How would you guys work? And so a lot of it is a group dynamic that a person, you know, might say, this happened to me this week. I didn't know what to do. And then it's problem solving among the group. And they actually, you know, can provide, some of the other group members provide great answers.
When you describe the results, they were positive. Can you be more concrete? That most of them kept the weight off. Most of them kept most of the weight off or some of the weight off. How do you describe that?
Well, as a group, actually, our Second Life group in the maintenance continued losing weight, which is really very uncommon. Most of the time, people, our traditional group slowly started gaining the weight back. At the end of the 9 months, though, it was a 3-month weight loss phase and a 9-month weight maintenance, 6-month weight maintenance phase. But at the end of the day, into that 9-month total period, both groups had still, you know, significant amount of weight loss, but the Second Life group had just maintained, you know, actually kept losing weight. So at the end of the time, they had greater weight loss.
So if I were in that group, I'd want to keep doing that.
Well, you would. But if you look at, in real life, what was different? Well, some of the behaviors that we know that are important for weight management were greater in our Second Life group. So our Second Life group ate significantly more fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. They had significantly more minutes of physical activity a week and more steps of physical activity a day. So the behaviors that we, you know, encourage that we know are important for weight loss and weight maintenance, they, you know, the group in Second Life did better at those behaviors.
And so the trick is to get them to graduate from Second Life then and to, you know, and maintain that without having the prompts of Second Life.
Right. Well, we actually, you know, we believe that the ability to practice those behaviors in Second Life led to better behavior change in real life.
Okay.
And then, yeah, I mean, any habit, once you get a habit going, if you can, you know, maintain it for a certain period of time, then it's easier for you to keep doing.
A healthy habit,
right.
Well, Dr. Deborah Sullivan, thanks for joining us today to talk about
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. Dr. Deborah Sullivan, she's a professor of clinical nutrition at the University of Kansas Medical Center. She chairs their Department of Dietetics and Nutrition. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation on Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Yes. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with the philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888.
Thursday night, WOSU-TV takes you across the country on North America's most spectacular railways. More than just a tour, Trains Around North America traces railroad history, from trains offering spectacular views to fast-paced trains. All aboard for Trains Around North America, Thursday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice to client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life, at sherringtongroup.com. This is WOSU 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Think back for a minute, if you can, to the ninth grade. I actually like the ninth grade, but some of us can't bear it. Some of us may have been head cheerleaders or presidents of our class, or maybe someone just ordinary like me. But very few 15-year-olds can say they invented something in high school that changed people's lives. Not so for my next guest, Savannah Kofer. Is part of a team at Columbus Academy in Gahanna that was chosen to participate in the National E-Cyber Mission Competition, sponsored by the U.S. Army in Washington, D.C. And we've brought her to the show to talk about what they designed that helps people. Welcome to the show, Savannah.
Hi.
Okay, the competition encourages students in grades 6 through 9 to develop solutions to real-world challenges in their local community. So first of all, how did you identify what you wanted to achieve?
Well, we actually have a close friend that's here today, and we saw that she had essential tremors. And we also have a lot of other friends, and we found that 14% of senior citizens have essential tremors. So this was definitely a big problem in our community.
Tell us, what are essential tremors?
Well, it's a neurological condition which causes involuntary movement of the hands, arms, or even in some cases the head. So it makes it difficult to do very simple tasks. So eating, drinking, putting on makeup, it makes it difficult.
And how many people does it affect?
It affects young people, less common, maybe 5%. It more common in middle-aged people. Actually, we found that for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, it affected up to 2/3 of them. So it was a very big problem for a lot of senior citizens.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Savannah Kofer. She's a ninth grader at Columbus Academy. We're talking about something that she and a team of students at Columbus Academy designed to address the problem of essential tremors. If you have a question or comment for Savannah, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So one thing, well, tell us what you designed then to address essential tremors. These are in the hands mostly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We wanted a non-invasive solution because some of the existing solutions, they're mostly invasive.
Like how?
So using medication, surgery. So we designed several different types of gloves that provided a resistance to the tremors.
How so? What do you mean by that?
Well, we developed solutions that involved elastic bands, using wires. We even considered gel, but we tested the different solutions to find the best one. And we found that the wires reduced the tremors by 65%. So this was definitely significant.
So describe the gloves to me. What do they look like?
Well, they're very form-fitting. We used a golf glove, actually, to attach wires to. We used 18-gauge aluminum wires, but we can also adjust the how thick they are. So, I mean, we wanted a very tight glove that wasn't obtrusive or get in the way.
Okay, so and one thing that's great about this glove is this is very low cost. It's very affordable.
Yeah.
Was keeping the price down part of your original plan?
Yeah, we wanted something that was affordable for everybody to use. So our solution only costs $8.35, so that's affordable for anybody.
And that's doing just one at a time. It could be, of course, much cheaper if you're mass producing them, right?
Yeah, this is just the materials cost, not including labor or anything.
Okay. Joining us now is Erin Klepper. She's a senior at Gahanna Lincoln High, and she has a personal connection to the glove. Welcome to the show, Erin.
Hi.
So, Erin, you have hand tremors, right?
Yes, very minimal, but
Tell us what causes them and what they're like.
Well, from what I've learned in young people, it can be caused by things such as drugs or lack of sleep. In my case, I have a pretty wacky sleep schedule, so I'm pegging it on lack of sleep.
Okay, so but it is a physiological problem.
Yeah.
When did you notice you had hand tremors?
Well, my sophomore year, I noticed sometimes when I would eat that my hand would shake as I was lifting utensil up to my mouth, and I didn't really think of it as a big deal, but when Savannah had me over one time, they tested me with a prototype of their glove, and they found that I indeed had minimal tremors.
Did you know that Erin had tremors, Savannah, before you designed the glove, or you knew? Or
no, I didn't know at all that she had tremors, but we had an interesting app called iSeismometer, which we used the accelerometer on an iPhone to quantify the tremors. So we said, oh, why don't you try this app to see what kind of hand motion, and just for fun. But we found that she actually had essential tremors, and this was shown in the data.
So the app first defines whether or not somebody could use the glove.
Yes, and it also quantifies the G-forces used.
So you could decide how to make the glove.
Yeah, so
right.
We showed which ones worked better, which decreased the amplitude of the tremors the most.
Okay, so you've used the glove.
Yes.
Is it on both hands?
We tried it on my right hand because that's my dominant hand.
Okay. And what happened?
Well, just putting it on, you can feel like when you try to bend your fingers that it causes some like resistance. It's harder for you to move your fingers. So looking at the iSeismometer app, you could see that it was harder for my hand to have those minimal shakes and tremors.
Okay. And I guess the idea is then, Savannah, is tremors for a lot of people are a lot more serious. They're a lot more obvious, and they're debilitating for some people, right?
Right, and they also increase with age. So, I mean, Erin's very young. She's only in high school. But as you get older, then the tremors get worse, or they increase with stress. So it applies when Erin's a lot older as well.
Okay, Erin, get some sleep. Okay. But have you tried it on anybody else who is older who has more serious tremors?
Right. We tested on a variety of subjects, some with mild tremors like Erin, but some with more severe tremors. So it decreased the tremors for people with severe tremors a lot more because it was more significant and more debilitating.
And as far as veterans and stuff returning from the war, there's a lot of concerns and questions about how we're going to manage the health and welfare of them coming back.
Right.
Yeah. If you have a question or comment for my guests, Savannah Kofer, ninth grader at Columbus Academy, Erin Klepper, senior at Gahanna Lincoln High School, we're talking about the design of a new glove. Well, it's not a new glove, but it's a reimagining of a glove to help people with essential tremors. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Savannah is part of a team at Columbus Academy in Gahanna that was chosen to participate in the National E-Cyber Mission Competition sponsored by the U.S. Army in Washington, D.C. Ergo, they're probably pretty interested in your assertion about how it could help returning veterans. Of course, every team needs a leader. And here in the studio, we're joined by Haruna Kofer. She's the team advisor for the eCyber Mission Group. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what has your role been in getting these kids to Washington? Because you beat out 63 others in just the region to get to this stage.
That's correct. There are over 21,000 children who actually participated in this competition, and so they came out on top. That represents about 5,000 teams nationwide that competed in eCyber Mission. And my role, quite frankly, is really just to give them all the tools that they need, all the materials, all the contacts perhaps that they need to work with experts to complete their project. And so it's almost an administrative role.
How many other teams are headed to Washington?
There are 16 teams in all, so 15 others. But in the ninth grade, that's actually only three others. So they are one of four national
finalists.
That's
right. It was sixth through ninth grade.
That's correct.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is the 11th annual eCyber Mission Competition. Is it the first time Columbus Academy has reached this level?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What do you think about what Savannah was one of the lead designers. There are three students on the team. Where do you think, just from watching from above, the where it clicked for them, where this seemed like a good idea and something to pursue?
I think when they first realized that one of their own peers, Aaron here, has essential hand tremors, and then realizing that in their own lives that they knew people of all ages that have essential hand tremors. And the thing is, doctors really don't know what causes it. And so until they do find out, then they wanted to come up with a solution to deal with it on a day-to-day basis. Because as Savannah said, it affects everyday life. It affects eating, drinking, texting, many different functions.
And Savannah, how do you, when you're talking about their golf gloves, so they're very tight fitting, where do you fit the wires into the gloves?
Well, it's mostly along the fingers, because from observing people with essential tremors, the tremors start in the wrist, or in the upper arm, but they are most amplified in the fingers, and that's the part that needs to be stabilized the most. But we can also design gloves that go up that stabilize the wrist as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mostly in the fingers.
And is it something they have to wear all the time, or only when they're trying to text, or only when they're trying to eat, or during those kind of times when they are more debilitating?
Well, it all depends on the person. So if you have struggles with doing something, you might want to wear it all the time or just for a specific event. So it definitely depends.
Erin, what have you found? Did they give you a glove?
No, but I mean, I tried them and it seems to have worked a lot. And seeing as art is a pretty strong passion of mine, mm-hmm. So knowing that I have these minimal tremors, if it starts to worsen with my age, I might find that it's harder to do things like draw or paint with the tremors. So I might turn to them for a glove if need be.
What other things were tossed by the wayside in your journey in this project, Savannah?
Well, we investigated different materials. So, for example, we tested gloves using rubber bands. But actually,
how would that work? What do you mean by how would that have worked?
There were elastic bands that were anchored at the fingertips, but held onto by the wrist. So the more that you close your hand, the stronger it pulls.
Okay.
So this was kind of a problem, because when your hands are completely extended, there's not very much tension. And we tested this with the accelerometer, and we found that it didn't decrease the tremors. I mean, it did, but not as much as the wires.
Mm-hmm. And you said gel as well?
Yeah, we considered making a glove out of gel, but we wanted something that was very streamlined and easy to use and doesn't get in the way very much. And gel might be messy, and it's definitely more bulky compared to thin wires.
The whole idea of this, the whole idea of the glove and addressing essential tremors, before you decided on that, what other ideas did you think about?
Well, we were thinking about application-specific devices, so devices made specifically for eating or specifically for writing. But we also wanted something that was universal, that could be used in any situation.
Mm-hmm.
So because the glove goes with you wherever and is not application-specific, then we decided on this idea.
You said something about gel, too. How would that have... You tried gel with the gloves?
We tested a little bit, but not in a formal design, just because it was so bulky.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's many different materials that if you put some pressure or tension on it, then it stiffens up. But we thought that this would be way too bulky and not get in the way.
Do you have any idea what you're going to be up against in Washington when you get there, what the competition is?
Well,
we actually have very little information. It is in their press release, but it's just a name. And it looks like there's perhaps a team from Virginia about texting. And there's actually a team from China, from an American school in China, that they'll be up against as well.
And what's it going to be like? What are you going to have to show them? Are you bringing Aaron along or what?
Well, it'll just be the three team members that designed the ideas, so me and two others, presenting the ideas to judges, but also getting to meet the other teams, so that'll be a good experience.
Do you show them video of someone like Aaron or something wearing the glove, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we'll have the video, but we'll also bring the gloves in person and the accelerometer, so they'll see how we made the tests and what the prototypes look like.
What's going to be the hardest thing for you in terms of describing your design to the... to the judges?
Well, what you just described is that bringing a video, we won't have a live demonstration there, so we'll need to explain our design without the use of a actual hand tremor patient.
And what kind of statistics did you pull together to prove your point?
Well, we have the data that we collected using the accelerometer and what the peak height tremor reduction was. But we also did many realistic experiments. So, for example, we had the hand tremor patients hold a brimming cup of water and measure in grams how much water they spilled, or a spoonful of water to see how much they spilled, and it reduced it by 81%. So that was a really big reduction, and it really motivated us that our tremor glove would actually work and have a significant impact.
What did each of you do in the project?
Well, we all came up with the idea together and brainstormed with the different types, but we also divided up to who would build the prototype, who would test it, analyze the data, make a report.
Okay.
So there was a lot of teamwork involved in the process.
Okay. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm talking with Savannah Kofer. She's a ninth grader at Columbus Academy. She's part of a team that is headed to Washington, D.C. When are you going?
In a few weeks.
In a few weeks after school's out to put forth their an invention created to control the effects of essential tremors. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Marilyn in Dayton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Marilyn.
Yes, I would like for them, I think they should contact the International Essential Tremor Foundation so that because there are 10 million people, over 10 million people with essential tremor that could use the glove.
Marilyn, do you have essential tremor?
Yes, I do.
What does it sound like to you, this glove? Does it make sense?
Yes, it does.
You would use one, you think?
Well, I don't because I have it in my head.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I belong to a support group that a lot of people have in their hand because it is a condition that it bothers the hand and the head, the voice.
Okay.
And sometimes the legs.
Have you thought, Savannah, about how you could broaden the scope of the effect of your design?
Well, not extensively, but we have thought about how we can use resistance for other parts of the body. But for now, we just focus on the hands mostly because that's the most common.
All right. Well, Marilyn, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank my guests, Savannah Kofer, ninth grader at Columbus Academy. Good luck in Washington.
Thanks.
Also, Haruna Kofer, she's eCyber Mission Team Advisor at Columbus Academy. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Aaron Klepper, senior at Gahanna Lincoln High School, who needs more sleep, but thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. And good luck to Columbus Academy team. It's been chosen to participate in the National eCyber Mission Competition sponsored by the U.S. Army in Washington, D.C. We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
On the next Fresh Air, how opioid painkillers came to be used in the treatment of chronic pain, like back problems, and what the consequences have been. We talk with New York Times reporter Barry Meyer, author of the new ebook, A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake. And John Powers tells us about his favorite films at the Cannes Film Festival. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Bethel Dental Care, providing general dentistry from pediatrics to geriatrics in a comfortable atmosphere. A proud supporter and promoter of WOSU programming. More information at 614-451-0341 or online at betheldentalcare.com.
Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit wosu.org/membercard for more information. And thanks for your membership in 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. With television shows like The Biggest Loser, I guess, glorifying the benefits of grueling workouts that leave us gasping for breath, it's easy to think that the harder you work, the faster you'll see results. But that's not always necessarily the case. And in some instances, that line of thinking can be deadly. Dr. Diane Gorgas, she's a professor of emergency medicine at Wexner Medical Center. She sees firsthand what happens when exercise goes too far and has written about it recently. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Gorgas.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
In your most recent column in the Columbus Dispatch, you write about a 34-year-old man who decided to follow one of those extreme boot camp videos, so without anyone around, and he ended up with a very rare, but not so rare as I thought, and very serious condition. Tell us about him and what you wrote.
Well, you're absolutely right that the mechanism of his injury to get to this profound muscle breakdown is rare and unusual. The injury itself occurs when muscle is under so much trauma that it can leak or leach out the proteins that normally sit within the muscular tissue into the bloodstream. Those proteins can gum up the kidneys and prevent them from working normally, and you get all of the sequela downstream of acute kidney dysfunction or renal failure, including electrolyte abnormalities, the potential for permanent kidney failure from this, problems with acid-base balance, and it can be a life-threatening condition. It's called rhabdomyolysis.
He made a lot of mistakes. Let's start off with this guy. Just everything about what he did was wrong, wrong, wrong. He started out deciding he wanted to lose weight fast. He was thinking of in about a month instead of a 6 month or 8 month or 9 month period. He had his last pizza the night before. He started this routine. Tell us what he did that weekend.
His goal was to lose 10 pounds by the end of the weekend. And he was going to do this come heck or high water. And that meant that he was going to start a boot camp type program, one of the ones that you see advertised on early morning television. But he was going to complete the first 2 weeks of it in a weekend. So he essentially did 17 boot camp sessions in 2 days, despite his body screaming at him to stop, and took on a pretty restrictive water intake diet at the same time, thinking that water weight's the easiest weight to lose. Maybe by Monday he'll be 10 pounds lighter, even if it is water weight. That is his goal, and he's going to reach it. So not only did the kidneys have to struggle with the proteins from the muscle breakdown, but they had to do so in a condition that was very concentrated. So the damage was just augmented.
I guess some people might want to say, what was he thinking? Were you able to talk to him at all about what his logic was in approaching weight losses in this way?
A lot of times we see this all-or-nothing phenomena, that the sins of the past can be repaired relatively quickly. And as people advance in age, and 34 does not sound like a terribly advanced age, but when he was in his 20s, he said that he could drop 10 pounds in a week easily. Well, metabolisms change as time moves on, and using those same kind of extreme goals that may have been achievable, although not very healthy in your 20s, and applying those to your 30s and 40s, it seems like a good idea. It seems like a jumpstart of a diet, but I think that that was one of the fatal flaws in his decision.
I would imagine, even with one of those workouts we see advertised on television, that they tell you don't start any new workout without consulting your physician first.
Right.
And would any physician ever say that what he was proposing to do was healthy, let alone
I certainly
effective?
Hope not. Kind of adding to the national collective consciousness about weight loss is when these extreme weight loss shows actually have a physician that acts as the rational voice during consultation during these. But the bottom line is losing half of your body weight in an accelerated fashion over months, if not even a year, is just not healthy, and it's a tremendous strain on the body. So putting a physician in front of that endorsement, I don't think really helps.
Sometimes, you know, the line between pushing yourself and making yourself sick can be hard to draw. Mm-hmm. And what this guy did was patently, well, I can't even imagine why waste a good weekend working out the whole weekend is my
exactly.
my philosophy, and I don't mind working out. But do you have any guidelines someone should follow?
That phrase that we used to hear frequently back in the 80s, no pain, no gain.
Right.
I think that we've discovered that that is the exact opposite philosophy. And the other idiom to keep in mind is that nothing comes easy and nothing should come quick. The weight gain doesn't happen overnight, and weight loss shouldn't happen overnight either. You can search the internet and find thousands of fad exercises, thousands of fad diets. But the bottom line is the only thing that works for sustainable health maintenance and weight loss is good nutrition and regular moderate exercise.
My guest is Dr. Diane Gorgas. She is residency director at the Emergency Medical Training Program, and she's also a columnist for the Dispatch. You've probably read her there. You can give us a call if you have a question or comment. What we're talking about here is something called rhabdomyolysis.
Exactly.
If you have a question or comment about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Are obese people naturally at a greater risk when it comes to doing tough workouts? For instance, this 34-year-old guy, was he what you would consider obese?
He did meet the criteria for being overweight, probably right on the border of being obese, which is actually just a simple measurement based on your height and your body mass. Rhabdomyolysis in and of itself is protein breakdown, and fat doesn't have a lot of protein. It's fat. Muscle has a lot of protein.
Okay.
So the larger your muscle mass, the more likely you are to develop rhabdo. A deconditioned patient with a large muscle mass, so a former athlete that's still muscular but hasn't worked out in a long time, that's a setup for rhabdomyolysis, even more than obesity would be.
You know, we've heard about this problem in college sports related scenarios, and I want to introduce to the show now Dispatch reporter, sports reporter Todd Jones. In March, he wrote a series of college sports-related cases about a series of college sports-related cases of rhabdomyolysis and myelysis, including a serious bout in March 2012 on the OSU women's lacrosse team. Welcome to the show, Todd Jones.
How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. I imagine these are pretty fit young people that we're talking about, and they were still affected by a too rigorous workout. What happened there?
Well, I think it was a case of, as you were talking with the doctor there, you know, even the best athletes can do too much too soon, something that's kind of out of context with what they normally do. And, you know, these athletes underwent a rigorous training activity in practice that wasn't normally what they do, and they kind of overextended themselves. And I think, you know, the culture of college athletics is, you know, you don't complain. You don't want a coach to think you're a complainer, so you keep pushing yourself, and they're trying to get better, and they ended up just doing too much. And, you know, six of them were hospitalized, and three of them for several days. And, you know, I just think it shows you that even the best athletes have to be careful about how they're doing and listen to their bodies, and the coaches need to be able to communicate, you know, with the strength coaches, the head coaches, the athletes. There all needs to be better communication sometimes about, you know, what's going on here in a practice.
Yeah, but we're talking about people who are paid to know how to work with athletic training and how to do athletic training. And yet, and these are elite athletes. These are Big Ten college athletes. This is, you know, kind of where everybody hopes they can be at a college level. And yet they weren't ready for it. What did we learn from their experience? Did OSU provide any answers about that?
Well, I mean, OSU did a report, and it was kind of an in-house report that they didn't make public, you know, which contrasts with what the University of Iowa had done like 14 months prior to that when Rabdo, a case broke out among its football team. They had the Board of Trustees ordered that an investigative committee be formed, and that included doctors and medical personnel, and they looked into, you know, that kind of a root cause analysis of what happened. Ohio State's report was, let's just say it was not quite as in-depth, and, you know, they took a look at some of the factors that I mentioned. You know, maybe better communication is needed between the athletes and the coaches and the trainers about, you know, what are we doing here and whether or not it's, you know, going too far or inappropriate. And, you know, they're trying to, Ohio State's stance was we're trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again, obviously, among Ohio State. I think some of the families objected and thought that Ohio State, being an educational institution, should have used the case as a way to try to help educate other universities by doing a root cause analysis and saying, hey, this is the mistakes we made. You can learn from us. And I think that was kind of the gist of the problem that the families had with Ohio State's response.
Do you know what exactly they were doing that brought about this condition in those six athletes?
Well, it was basically the athletes, they did a bunch of cardio work, push-ups, pull-ups, different things like that, that just kind of went beyond the norm of what they do. And doctors will say, you know, if you overextend yourself in certain parts of your body that you normally don't do, if you're not building up to a say you try to all of a sudden do 50 pull-ups and you normally don't even
see
do
if I all of a sudden try to do one pull-up. Go on, Tad.
So it's kind of like put, you know, again, even the best athletes at a Division I school, if you're doing something that you don't normally do and you overextend yourself, it can lead to problems. And and part of the problem is that the athletes, you know, in general, they don't know what rhabdo is, and like these athletes never even heard of it. And which I thought was alarming, considering that 14 months earlier it had happened at another Big Ten school. So you would think that, you know, educationally, let's get the word out and let's teach, you know, people about what this is, how to avoid it, because it is very avoidable.
And it's also can be very deadly, right, Diane?
Yeah,
I mean,
in an extreme case, yeah, definitely. I mean, not to be an alarmist, because, you know, the fact of the matter is, from my understanding from talking to experts, is that a lot of us can get rhabdo and not even know it, and it, you know, kind of quickly flushed out of your system in a day or so. But it can get extreme, and it can affect the kidneys, and there's been cases where it's been fatal. So it's obviously something that, you know, people need to know more about, and not just run-of-the-mill athletes or, you know, you or me trying to go to the gym and do something, even the best athletes in the world. I mean, NFL athletes have had cases of rhabdo, and where you really see it a lot is in the military, you know, from, like, boot camp.
Interesting, right. You know, Diane Gorgas, is it an either-or? I mean, is it either you get a mild case or you have kidney failure and you wind up in the hospital? Can you have permanent damage? You may live, but you have permanently damaged your kidney?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And those are the more extreme cases. Todd's right that most of these cases are kind of subclinical. If you ever talk to long-distance runners or marathoners and they say after a particularly grueling 26 miles that they notice blood in their urine. Well, that's not blood. That's myoglobin, and that is muscle breakdown products that they're seeing in their urine. And most of those athletes know that they hydrate extra well after a run, and there's no long-term ill effects from it. But the type of rhabdo that causes people to be admitted to the hospital, that level of muscle breakdown is really similar to injuries that we saw in Haiti after the earthquake, those muscle-crushing type of injuries. It's similar to high-voltage electrocution injuries that we see when somebody grabs onto a live electrical wire. That's the amount of muscle breakdown that we're talking about that can lead to permanent kidney damage.
Todd, you know, your story went on to note other known cases of rhabdomyolysis, and there is 2012, 2011, 2011, 2011, 2010, 2010, 2009, 2000. These are just a few that you knew about at the college level. That's a lot.
Yeah, and that's kind of the key. I mean, what I found when I started looking into this was that, wow, there are some cases popping up here and there, and nobody had really kind of tied it all together into like, wow, is this a trend? Or, you know, and there's some debate. Are we just becoming more aware of it? And there's always been this many cases, or, you know, you can argue that, you know, no, it's just that there's more and more cases of this. What you can't deny, obviously, is that at least publicly, we've become aware of cases in high schools and colleges in recent years that this has occurred in different sports. And, you know, I was a little taken aback by, like, just the approach. Like, for instance, at the University of Maine, they had five cases on their football team that sources told me that I trust, and it was never reported. And you call the University of Maine, and they don't confirm, deny, or comment. And I'm like, well, this is medical education. I mean, are you that afraid of bad publicity? You know, so you get a story in the paper that says, you know, unfortunately this happened. Isn't the public better served by saying this is what happened and this is how we can learn from it? That's what I was a little taken aback by, is that universities would take the approach that, you know, hush, hush, and, you know, don't even acknowledge that happened at the Miami University in Oxford with their soccer team and wasn't reported. And, you know, again, these are institutions of higher learning. And why don't we take something and say, okay, you know, mistakes were made, but how can we learn from these mistakes? And if we're doing public reports and trying to educate people about this, then some good can come from this. And so I think it's just something that, you know, people just need to learn more about. And that's kind of the goal of what I had. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, my articles weren't so much a gotcha and journalism and trying to point blame. My articles were just like, well, what is this? How can we learn from it? And if we learn from it, maybe we can avoid it in the future.
Diane Gorgas, maybe it's that we're spotting them more, but the way we approach exercise in this country is changing. It is becoming more extreme, whether it's physical fitness for an athlete or whether it's, you know, a lump like me who, you know, does a boot camp three or four times a week, if I'm lucky. It is more extreme, no doubt about it. They're on television advertising it, so there's a couple things going on here now, aren't there?
Yeah, let me first of all totally disagree that you are not a lump. But besides that, we are. Our lives have gotten much busier. We're really looking at bigger impact exercises. So rather than walking for an hour, now we're trying to cram a boot camp, which is much more exertional and much more difficult on the muscles, into a shorter period of time. We're much more of a roller coaster society with our health, letting it decline and then trying to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and become fit specimens over a relatively short period of time. And that is something that popular media is really kind of feeding into, that it's a possibility, it's a reality that you can do this.
And likewise, Todd, at the collegiate level, the competition is so extreme now.
Oh, definitely. And again, you know, the whole mindset of an athlete, and this is not in any way to blame the athlete, but you know, the mindset is like, I don't want to complain. I don't want the coach to think that I'm slacking here.
Right.
I don't want to say I can't do this. So you're pushing yourself. Plus, they're very competitive, and they are pushing themselves.
That's how they got there.
Yeah, the key is, as several experts were saying to me, was that, you know, it's not up to them to avoid it. It's up to the professionals, the coaches, the trainers, to know that they can't be expecting this much out of them, and for them to say, you know, let's stop here.
Okay. Todd Jones, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me. Take care.
Todd Jones, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Diane Gorgas, residency director of the Emergency Medical Training Program and columnist for the Dispatch. Thanks for joining us, Diane.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Thanks for listening today on Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Program support is provided by the Arts and College Prep Academy. ACPA is now enrolling high school students looking for a safe and vigorous learning environment for all.